it is very clear that the head of the snake is the financial system. The whole point of finance is to indebt, otherwise to enslave. What is a mortgage? I mean, what does that stand for? It's a death grip. So when you get a mortgage, you have a death grip held over you because you are in debt. You don't even own the house. The bank owns the house that loans you the money to buy the house, unless you're fortunate enough to have all the money to buy it outright. And even then, you can be taxed by the government, and if you fail to keep up with those taxes, the government can then take it from you. The whole system is based on a financial fraud, which effectively takes the power that we have and it gives it to a tiny group of individuals who are running the world through the control of finance. With the infinite supply of money that we have allowed them to take, they have literally an infinite supply of money, and with that money, and from their psychopathic point of view, they have bought everything and everyone who can be bought. So those of us who cannot be bought, because we operate on a level that goes way beyond the material, we are not rewarded for such behavior, we are punished for such behavior. And the most slovenly, disgustingly criminal, pedophilia, corrupt moral individuals, those are the ones that are rewarded in this system, which is upside down. We reward the pedophiles, we reward the corrupt, we reward the liars, we reward the people with no morals at all.
In the middle of the 19th century, Moses Hess formulated the first written principles of communism. In 1862, Hess, or the communist rabbi as he was called, wrote the book Rome and Jerusalem, in which he laid the foundations for a Jewish nationalist movement called Zionism. In the book, he called on the Jewish people to become separatists and to prepare for the creation of a future homogeneous Jewish ethno-state. Palestine would be occupied by the Jewish people, but the big problem was Palestine was at this time 90-95% Arab. Hess argued that international Jewish bankers would help in this realization of stealing the land from the Palestinians. Hess suggested in his book that one last race and class struggle was being developed between the Aryans and the Semites. In this fight, Hess predicted that the Jews would stand as winners and the Europeans as losers. The Jews would stand superior over all other peoples, and because the Jews had preserved their racial purity over the centuries, it would give them a leading role in the world. Hess essentially promoted eugenics and racial hygiene for the Jews, and talked about a future Jewish ethno-state. He also referred to Christianity as the religion of death. Fascinatingly, he predicted a future war in Europe, with Germany, Italy, and Austria involved as part of a race struggle. Moses Hess was a close friend and collaborator of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, which he converted to communism and assisted them in their work with the Communist Manifesto in 1848. This proves that socialism, Marxism, communism, and Zionism in fact share the same roots. Although they travel different paths, they had the same common goal, domination of the world. They all work and plan for the day when the chosen race shall inherit the earth. Karl Marx, real name Moses Mordechai Levy, was descended from a long line of famous rabbis who were so-called Talmudic scholars, from which is the source his own philosophy was derived. Marx's grandfather was a rabbi by the name of Mordechai. In fact, his grandparents were related to the Jewish Rothschild family through marriage. Rothschild would also partially fund Karl Marx, who would be remembered as the Jewish father of communism. Le Droit de Vivre, May 12, 1936, said, "Jewry is the mother of Marxism." The Communist Manifesto laid out the ideology of communism. Its key points include a central bank with monopoly on credit, abolition of countries and nationalities, abolition of the traditional family consisting of a man, woman, and children, abolition of private property, which means no rights for the people, to make it impossible for people to earn a livelihood by introducing heavy taxation, confiscation of property, abolition of the right of inheritance, and a communist state, i.e. Jewish monopoly on credit and banking. The media in total control of the communists. Women should not focus on family and children anymore. In their own words, communism wants to do away with the status of women as mere instrument of production, and abolition of Christianity and morality. Marx refers to this totalitarian scheme as dictatorship of the proletariat, and his cult followers promote violence, class envy, and hostility towards free markets, family, business, tradition, and Christianity. Today, they are instrumental in the destabilization of Europe. Marx also openly encouraged genocide against Slavs, referring to them as racial trash, and that they must perish in a revolutionary holocaust.
I don't think many people know that only socialists publicly advocated genocide in the 19th, 20th centuries. I think that's a very little known fact, and it seems shocking if you mention it. I've lectured on it here and in other universities, and it's always greeted with a sense of shock. First appeared in January 1849 in Marx's journal Neue Rheinische Zeitung. Engels wrote of the how the class war in Marxian terms means that when socialist revolution happens, the class war happens, there will be primitive societies in Europe two stages behind, because they're not even capitalist yet. And he had in mind the Basques and the Bretons and the Scottish Highlanders and the Serbs, and he calls them racial trash, Völkerabfälle, racial trash, and they will have to be destroyed, because being two stages behind in the historical struggle, it will be impossible to bring them up to the point of being revolutionary.
He spoke about vulgarity and dirtiness of Slavic people, you see. And he thinks, for instance, that Poland had has no reason to exist.
The classes and the races, too weak to master the new conditions of life, must give way. They must perish in the revolutionary holocaust. Karl Marx.
Marx began it. He was the ancestor of modern political genocide. And I don't know that any European thinker of the modern period before Marx and Engels ever publicly advocated racial extermination. I can't find anything earlier, so I presume it starts with them.
In his 1920 article, Zionism versus Bolshevism, A Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People, Winston Churchill stated his belief that international Jews were seeking a worldwide communist state under Jewish domination. The international Jews would use communism and Zionism to accomplish this. As a first step towards establishing Israel, Hezekiah Niles described in Niles' Weekly Register article that the Rothschilds had purchased Jerusalem in 1829.
Rothschild helped found Israel, and Rothschild has always been the backer of Israel. Whatever Rothschild wants, he gets. It is believed that he is the richest man in the world, and I have little doubt of that.
In 1887, the first Zionist Congress was held in Basel, Switzerland, and was chaired by Theodor Herzl. Jewish delegates from across Europe agreed that Palestine should be given to them. Prior to his death in 1904, Herzl predicted that a world body will one day give Palestine to the Jews, and that he will go down in history as the father of the Jewish state. For Herzl's dream to come true, European military powers would have to be manipulated and used into taking Palestine away from the Ottomans by force. In the German newspaper Deutsche Zeitung, Herzl wrote, "The wealthy Jews rule the world. The fate of the governments lies in their hands. They start wars between countries, and when they wish, the governments make peace. When the wealthy Jews sing, the nations and their leaders dance along. And meanwhile, the Jews get richer." Dr. Wolfson said in New York Times article in August 22, 1907, that Jewish people must conquer the world. Communism was devoted to abolish private property in order to concentrate all wealth and power in the hands of the global central banking cabal. Around 250 years ago, in 1760, Mayor Amschel Rothschild created the House of Rothschild that paved the way for international banking and control of the world's resources.
Money is power. Money is the only weapon that the Jew has to defend himself with.
Meyer Amschel Bauer, born in Frankfurt, Germany in 1744, was a moneylender and a goldsmith on Jew Street, whose shop had a sign out front with a red hexagram on it. Eventually, he would change his name to Rothschild, which is German for red sign. Rothschild soon learned that loaning money to governments and kings was more profitable than loaning money to private individuals. Not only were the loans bigger, but they were secured by the nation's taxes. Meyer Rothschild had five sons whom he trained in the skills of money creation and sent out to the major capitals of Europe to open branches of the family banking business.
You are five brothers. I want you each to start a banking business in a different country. One to go and open a house in Paris, one in Vienna, one in London. Choose the most important centers, so that when money is to be sent from here to London, let us say, you won't have to risk life and gold and kill here in Frankfurt. We'll just send a letter to Nathan in London saying, pay so-and-so. And that will be offset by loans from London to Frankfurt. Understand?
Yes.
In your day, there will be many wars in Europe. And nations that have money to transport will come to the Rothschilds because it will be safe. Our five banking houses may cover Europe, but you will be one firm, one family, the Rothschilds, who work always together. That will be your power.
Just how rich and powerful is Lord Evelyn Rothschild? Historically, the Rothschild family wealth was hidden in underground vaults. The Rothschild's secret financial records were never audited and never accounted for. Their family commissioned biographies give the illusion that their family fortune has dwindled, but researchers estimate their wealth at close to $500 trillion, more than half the wealth of the entire world. Besides their many castles, palace mansions, wineries, racehorses, and exotic resorts, the Rothschilds bought Reuters in the 1800s. Reuters then bought the Associated Press, which selects and delivers the same news stories to the entire world, day after day. They have controlling interest in three major television networks and easily avoid media attention since they own it. Until recently, they owned and operated England's Royal Mint and continue to be the gold agent for the Bank of England, which they also direct. They control the LBMA, London Bullion Market Association, where 30 to 42 million ounces of gold worth over $11 billion are traded daily. The Rothschilds earn millions weekly just on transaction fees alone. They also fix the world price of gold on a daily basis and profit from its ups and downs. Over the centuries, the Rothschilds have amassed trillions of dollars worth of gold bullion in their subterranean vaults and have cornered the world's gold supply. They own controlling interest in the world's largest oil company, Royal Dutch Shell. They operate phony charities and offshore banking services where the wealth of the black nobility and the Vatican is hidden in secret accounts at Rothschild Swiss banks, trusts, and holding companies. Although Evelyn Rothschild looks like a harmless gray-haired old man, make no mistake about it, Rothschild and his ancestors have handpicked presidents, crashed stock markets, bankrupted nations, orchestrated wars, and sponsored the mass murder and impoverishment of millions. The wealth hoarded by this one family alone could feed, clothe, and shelter every human being on earth.
The Rothschilds is the head of the snake. Within the city of London, there is a 1 mile square that is referred to as the city. This is the headquarters of the Jewish family Rothschild's banking dynasty that owns the money supply through the central banks of almost every nation on earth. In November 1910, seven of the world's richest Jewish men held a secret meeting on Jekyll Island just off the coast of Georgia to establish a central bank, which they called the Federal Reserve Bank. These men were Nelson Aldrich and Frank van der Lip, both representing the Rockefeller financial empire, Henry Davison, Charles Norton, and Benjamin Strong, representing J.P. Morgan, and Paul Warburg, representing the Rothschild banking dynasty of Europe. There were some powerful men who made it abundantly clear that they were not in favor of the Federal Reserve System. Their total wealth today would be worth nearly $11 billion. These were Benjamin Guggenheim, Isidor Strauss, and Jacob Astor. Unfortunately, all of them were on board Titanic when it sank to the depths of the sea. All three died that night. By April 1912, all opposition to the Federal Reserve had been eliminated. On December 23, 1913, after many senators and congressmen had left town for Christmas, the President Wilson signed a bill and the privately owned Federal Reserve System came into being in the United States. After Woodrow Wilson had signed the Federal Reserve Act, which gave private interests control of economic power in 1913, he said, "I am a most unhappy man. I've unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is now controlled by its system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated. The growth of the nation, therefore, and all our activities are in the hands of a few men. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the civilized world. No longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and endurance of a small group of dominant men." Jewish bankers and their rabbis actually celebrated the passage of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. After the Federal Reserve was up and running, Charles August Lindbergh added, "The financial system has been turned over to the Federal Reserve Board. The system is private, conduct for the sole purpose of obtaining the greatest possible profits for the use of other people's money." The Federal Reserve System was neither federal, nor does it contain reserves, and nor is it a part of a decentralized system. The adoption of the debt-based financial system preached by Marx in the Communist Manifesto had been accomplished. The current banking system, fractional reserve banking, enables privately owned banks to create money out of thin air. Money today is simply numbers in a computer system, with only about 3% existing as physical currency. Through its control and monopoly of our money, the elite that own the Federal Reserve now have total control over other banks, corporations, money, and politicians. The Fed system is designed to enslave us to never-ending debt and to fool us to believe that our money has any real value, when it is in fact worthless, created out of thin air, based on debt, and backed by nothing. it must enslave humanity to protect its monopoly over credit. Its money-creating tricks enabled Big Brother government to borrow endless money from the Fed. The Fed were now controlled by the Jews, Rothschild, Warburg, and Schiff. Every Federal Reserve chairman since 1980 has been Jewish: Burns, Volcker, Greenspan, Bernanke, and Yellen. The House of Rothschild owns 57% of the stock of the privately held Federal Reserve Bank.
What is the proper relationship, what should be the proper relationship between a chairman of the Fed and a president of the United States?
Well, first of all, the Federal Reserve is an independent agency, and that means basically that there is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take.
The Jew Harold Wallace Rosenthal explained, "Our power has been created through the manipulation of the national monetary system. The Federal Reserve System fitted our plan nicely, since it is owned by us. But the name implies that it's a government institution. From the very outset, our purpose was to confiscate all the gold and silver, replacing them with worthless, non-redeemable paper notes. We, Jews, have put issue upon issue to the American people. Then we promote both sides of the issue as confusion reigns. With their eyes fixed on the issue, they fail to see who is behind every scene. We, Jews, glory in the fact that the stupid goy have never realized that we are the parasites consuming an increasing portion of production while the producers are continually receiving less and less." We have to understand that one of the most powerful tools the globalists have for profit and control is war. The most lucrative thing that can happen for the international bankers and the globalists is war, for it forces the country to borrow even more money from the Federal Reserve Bank at interest.
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom, trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. I'm guided by a signal in the heavens. I'm guided by this birthmark on my skin. I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
The next goal for the elite was to finish off Christian Russia, and from there, launch an invasion of the rest of Europe. According to the State Department's documents, a group of Jews, including Jacob Schiff, Felix Warburg, Otto Kahn, Mortimer Schiff, Isaac Seligman, already planned the overthrow of the Russian Tsar in 1916. They decided that Russia should be destroyed and a communist slave regime would be implemented. The fact that we will never learn in school is that communism actually was a Jewish totalitarian ideology invented by Jews, funded by Jewish bankers, and economically manifested by Jewish Bolsheviks as Vladimir Lenin, Trotsky, Kaganovich, Yagoda. The family of Tsar Nicholas II, his wife Alexandra, his daughters Olga, Tatiana, Maria, Anastasia, and his son and successor Alexei were devout Orthodox Christians. They exemplified everything that was precious in a traditional family. As a boy, Tsar Nicholas II had witnessed the assassination of the Tsar Alexander II by the Jewish terrorist Vera Figner, leader of a terrorist group called the People's Will. Tensions between the Jews and the Christian Russians started. Nicholas' great tragic mistake was in failing to execute the communist before it was too late after a failed 1905 revolution. Now, his kindness would return to haunt him and his family. The Bolsheviks forced the Tsar to abdicate. The Jew Alexander Kerensky was given $1 million from the Jewish Wall Street banker Jacob Schiff to immediately free all political prisoners and lift the ban on political exiles to permit them to return to Russia. Revolutionaries quickly flooded in to any and all public offices. Anarchy began as criminals plundered houses and people were murdered and robbed. Jacob Schiff was chairman of the Kula Bank and an assistant of the Jewish Rothschilds. He took care of the contacts between the revolutionary movement in Russia and the Jewish Masonic order, B'nai B'rith. On March 27, 1917, the Jews Jacob Schiff and Max Warburg sent Lev Davido Bronstein, better known as Trotsky, and his group of Jewish communists off to Russia to lead a Jewish revolution with no less than $20 million in gold, today worth billions. Some 90,000 exiles, mostly Jews and Freemasons, returned from all over the world to infiltrate Russia. Most of them changed their Jewish names to blend into the European society better. Another banker who financed the revolution was the Swedish Jew Olaf Aschberg of the Nya Bank in Stockholm. Olaf's grandson, Robert Aschberg, is a former member of the Swedish Communist Party and today leader of the Zionist anti-white organization called Expo in Sweden. Trotsky recruited Russian Jews from the immigrant population of the Lower East Side of Manhattan and trained them as armed revolutionaries. Lenin, Marlow, Radek, and Kamenev returned from Switzerland. Stalin, Sverdlov, and Sinyonyev returned from Siberia. The Jewish chairman of the Central Executive Committee, Jacob Sverdlov, sent a message to the Jew Jacob Jurovsky, head of the Lokotcheka, where he communicated that he had received orders from Jacob Schiff to eliminate the Tsar and his entire family. Sverdlov ordered Jurovsky to carry out this order. In the spring of 1918, the Tsar and his family were taken to Ekaterinburg in the Urals, where Jacob Jurovsky was given the mission to imprison, plan, and assassinate the imperial family. Jurovsky brought the Tsar Nicholas and his family to a house that previously had belonged to a wealthy Jewish merchant named Ipatyev. Nicholas' imperial family was abruptly woken in the middle of the night on July 17, 1918, when the Jurovsky told the imperial family to dress and then brought them to the basement. They were told that they were going to pose for a group photograph, but the Jewish assassins, Jurovsky, Nikolin, Jermakov, and Vaganov, had other plans in mind. Seconds later, Jurovsky then pulled out his revolver and aimed it straight at the Tsar's head and fired. Nicholas died instantly. Next, he shot Tsarina Alexandra as she made the sign of the cross. Olga, Tatiana, Maria, and Anastasia were shot next. The daughters were stabbed to death after the initial gunfire had failed to kill them. Their doctor and three servants were also murdered in cold blood. Items that were related to the imperial family were burned and destroyed. Nothing was saved of the family. Even their dogs were slaughtered. News of the brutal murder of the Romanovs would send shockwaves throughout Russia and all of Europe. To some Jews, though, the slaughter of the Romanov family was treasured as a Jewish ritual murder. In selected Jewish-owned shops, they sold greeting cards with images that were unavailable for Gentiles. The postcards carried the image of the Tzaddik. This is an image of a rabbinical Jew with the Torah in his hand and a white fowl in the other. The head of the depicted foal is clearly shown to be the Imperial Russian Tsar Nicholas II. Below this image is the inscription in Hebrew. This is a sacrificial animal, so is my cleansing. It will be my replacement in cleansing the victim. A bloody civil war between the Red Jews, led by Trotsky, and the White Christians, led by Admiral Kolchak, broke out before the Jews could grab full power of the Soviet powerhouse to set up their own Bolshevik totalitarian system. David R. Francis, U.S. ambassador to Russia, said in January 1918, "The Bolshevik leaders here in Russia, most of whom are Jews, and 90% of whom are returned exiles, care little for Russia or any other country, but are internationalists, and they're trying to start a worldwide social revolution." The Jewish role in the Communist Revolution was mentioned in many major Jewish publications, such as the Jewish Encyclopedia and the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia and the Encyclopaedia Judaica. In fact, they are boasting about the essential role of the Jews in the Russian Revolution. The Jewish Chronicle said, "There is much in the fact of Bolshevism itself, in the fact that so many Jews are Bolshevists, in the fact that the ideals of Bolshevism at many points are consonant with the finest ideals of Judaism." Of the 22 ministers in the first Soviet government, 17 were Jews. The few who were not themselves Jewish often were Freemasons, had Jewish wives, and spoke Yiddish. We can't know for sure if Stalin was Jewish, but at least he spoke Yiddish and had three Jewish wives. Some historians claim that Stalin was Georgian, and some say that he was a Georgian Jew. Los Angeles B'nai B'rith Messenger, for example, stated that Stalin was a Jew. Stalin's real name was Iosif Vissarionovich Djugashvili. The Jewish writer Moritz Steinschneider invented the term anti-Semitic in 1860. The term would be used to silence all those that dared to expose Jewish crimes. Because of the predominantly Jewish character of the regime, the very first piece of legislation approved by the communist regime was the Anti-Semitism Act in 1917. Anti-Semitism was made a capital crime. An anti-communist was regarded as an anti-Semite. Leon Trotsky also started using the word racist to browbeat all dissenters of the communist ideology and to render debate impossible. These words are used still to this day to bully any politically incorrect person into silence. Even more now than ever, they're trying to make it punishable to question or criticize their actions by calling it hate speech, fake news, or anti-Semitic.
Anti-Semitism is used as a great blockade. When somebody's called an anti-Semite, it's usually because they've asked some question or made some comment about Jewish behavior in some way, shape, or form. And because Jews don't want to discuss that behavior, they call you an anti-Semite for daring to question that Jews do anything bad ever. That's really why it is used. Anytime you say something about Jews, Zionists, Israel, anything with a tangent to Jews that is in a negative light, you're going to be called an anti-Semite by the Jews, because this is the defense mechanism that they use to cover up their crimes and to prevent analysis of the criminal action that has happened, which so very often leads to a Jewish perpetrator. The Jewish philosophy is, how did Franz Seiler describe it the other day? It is an excuse to commit crimes. That's all it is. You put all your morals aside and you can do anything. That's the Jewish philosophy. And of course, the other part of it for the people who actually are Jewish and following the dictates of the Talmud believe that they are better than everybody else, and they act accordingly, and we see the horror in the world that is generated by that insanity.
You must understand, the leading Bolsheviks who took over Russia
were not Russians. They hated Russians. They hated Christians. Driven by ethnic hatred, they tortured and slaughtered millions of Russians without a shred of human remorse. The October Revolution was not what you call in America the Russian Revolution. It was an invasion and conquest over the Russian people. More of my countrymen suffered horrific crimes at the blood-stained hands than any people or nation ever suffered in the entirety of human history. It cannot be understated. Bolshevism was the greatest human slaughter of all time. The fact that most of the world is ignorant of this reality is proof that the global media itself is in the hands of the perpetrators. We cannot state that all Jews are Bolsheviks, but without Jews, there will be no Bolshevism. For a Jew, nothing is more insulting than the truth. The blood-matted Jewish terrorists murdered 66 million in Russia from 1918 to 1957. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Nobel Prize-winning novelist, historian, and victim of Jewish Bolshevism.
They were taught to be ruthless.
Vis-a-vis?
The Goyim. It was a virtue to be ruthless to the Goyim. I mean, you can say, okay, it's just cheating them economically, but I mean, that's a form of aggression. And you were taught that if you cheated the Goyim, you didn't have to feel guilty. And so it's only a step there from taking that to the, to executing the Goyim.
The Jewish Bolsheviks implemented a policy known as collectivization. By collectivization, they could take away the peasants' land in the name of the state. This was what Marx himself described as the essence of communism, to abolish private property. In early 1930, over 91% of the agricultural land was collectivized. The communists were taking every good from the peasants. All weapons of the civilians were also confiscated by the state.
He ordered NKVD to confiscate all grain, all food from these areas. By doing that, he knew he is condemning them to death.
Картошку, свеклу, это самое капусту, соленая капуста в бочке, с бочкою. Когда забираешь, садить же нужно. Нужно посадочным ни то не собрать и все.
December 4th, 1921, Samara District, Soviet Russia. Today I came upon a group of men in a makeshift cemetery digging a mass grave. When I asked where the bodies were, one of them explained, "We are trying now to make a place to put the future corpses. We are afraid we won't have the strength to do it later." As I looked at them, I wondered if any of those men thought he might be digging his own grave. Will Shafroth, American Relief Administration.
The famine of 1921 would become the worst disaster in Europe since the Black Plague in the Middle Ages.
The government carried out mass requisitioning of grain, which prevented peasants from feeding themselves or even having enough seed to carry on next season planting a new crop.
People had fled their villages, desperate to escape the famine. At the station at Kazan on the northern Volga, wretched creatures huddled together in compact masses like a seal colony. Most were children whose mothers had deserted them or had died.
I saw emaciated little skeletons whose gaunt faces and toothpick legs testified to the truth of the report that they were dying daily by the dozen. The stench was nauseating.
An estimated 25,000 Russians died in these regions each week. 75,000 more deaths by the end of March. People had been dying at this rate all over Russia, all winter. Will Shafroth described a scene he witnessed in Samara.
I have seen piles of corpses, half naked and frozen into the most grotesque positions, with signs of having been preyed upon by wandering dogs. I have seen these bodies, and it is a sight that I can never forget. It is impossible to describe the suffering and misery that presented itself on every side. I found the only food was made from weeds mixed with ground-up bones, tree bark, and clay.
The famine was awful. People were eating almost everything that could be swallowed. They ate straw from the roof.
Using this straw and such substitutes of food, they became ill and they look something like a fat man, but it was the beginning of their illness.
We ate all cats, dogs, horses, everything.
Shafroth cabled Haskell in Moscow that the body of a Russian assistant who recently died from typhus had been dug up and eaten. 10 butcher shops, he said, had been closed for selling human flesh. Americans read that Shafroth himself had been eaten.
The government tried to stop people eating corpses. And they led propaganda against this, and they tried to put guards in the cemeteries in order to prevent people from eating dead bodies.
Grandma told me about it. When the dark was coming, they put a huge lock to save children, because children were the main target of cannibals.
There were cases of killing children by their own mothers, by their own parents, and eating them. Some mothers did that for mercy, but some mothers killed them to feed other children, especially very small babies.
The starvation would peak in the winter and affect 16 million people. Before the corn and wheat seed arrived, up to 5 million Russians had starved to death.
During the periods of 1921 to 1922, 1932 to 1933, and 1946 to 1947, the Jewish Bolshevik regime deliberately mechanized 3 series of genocidal man-made famines aimed at starving farmers in Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Russia. Millions died a slow death, and people resorted to eating grass, and some even to cannibalism.
This real Holocaust is today referred to as the Holodomor. Encyclopedia Britannica estimates around 8 million people, 5 million of them Ukrainian, were starved to death by the Stalin-Kaganovich famine alone. And the three Holodomor genocides together resulted in a death toll of 16.5 million. Russian historian Alexander Solzhenitsyn estimated that between 1917 to 1958, the Jewish Bolshevik regime managed to exterminate up towards 60 million Europeans, including victims of the forced collectivization, the hunger, large purges, expulsions, banishment, executions, and mass deaths at gulags. Industrial-scale murders like these are an essential part of communist theory.
Але отако, як їдеш вулицею, лежать на два боки люди, мертві лежать, а ще котрий тріпається, просить, дай, 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 значить, бо це оце тобі таке робилося. А за ніч наздихає їх тих людей. Рано хуру дали, понакидали на хуру їх там 10-20, скільки там налізло, накидали.
Глянули у вікно, під'їхала пара волів, і то рундук. І ото куди попало, ногами і руками лежать люди. І висять із воза, і косає висить із воза. Так стало страшно та жалко. Ми кажемо, входів до нас, а каже, то як же я піду? Я ж кажу, мама і тато в хаті йдуть.
With these famines, Lenin, Stalin, Kaganovich, and all their Jewish agents destroyed any remaining resistance to the communists. An order from Lenin and Trotsky, the Red Terror, was first announced by the Jew Jakob Sverdlov. Lenin stipulated that three quarters of mankind may die, if necessary, to ensure the other quarter for communism. Lenin even outlined the purpose for the famines by stating, "Destroying the peasant economy and driving the peasant from the country to the town, the famine creates a proletariat." Lenin also regarded Europeans as animals. It is precisely now, and only now, when in the starving regions people are eating human flesh, and hundreds if not thousands of corpses are littering the roads, that we can, and therefore must, carry out the confiscation of church valuables with the most savage and merciless energy, not stopping short of crushing any resistance. He continued, "The greater the number of representatives of the reactionary clergy and reactionary bourgeoisie we succeed in executing for this reason, the better." Leon Trotsky said, "We must turn Russia into a desert populated by white Negroes, upon whom we shall impose a tyranny such as the most terrible Eastern despots never dreamt of. The only difference is that this will be a left-wing tyranny, not a right-wing tyranny. It will be a red tyranny and not a white one. We mean the word red, literally, because we shall shed such floods of blood as we will make all the human losses suffered in the capitalist wars pale by comparison. The biggest bankers across the ocean will work in the closest possible contact with us. If we win the revolution, we shall establish the power of Zionism upon the wreckage of the revolution's funeral. And we shall become a power before which the whole world will sink to its knees. We shall know what real power is, by means of terror and bloodbaths. We shall reduce the Russian intelligentsia to a state of complete stupefaction and idiocy, and to an animal existence." Mass arrest in the middle of the night, kidnapping, executions, and brutal tactics of torture took place. The communist plan was to use psychological warfare, torture, and terror to intimidate their white enemies into submission. Gendrich Yagoda was a Jewish secret police official who served as a director of the NKVD. A major Israeli publication, Ynet News, revealed the truth about Yagoda, saying, "We must not forget that some of the greatest mass murders of all time were Jewish." It goes on, Genndy Shigota was the greatest Jewish murderer of the 20th century. He is responsible for the deaths of at least 10 million people. The Jewish Checkout was a secret police force created through the NKVD, later KGB, on December 20, 1917, by the Jew Vladimir Lenin, and was consequently led by the Jew Felix Dzerzhinsky. Jews made up nearly 80% of the rank and file Sheka agents, reports Bruce Lincoln, an American professor of Russian history. The Sheka rounded up Christians and all those who did not support the Jewish Bolshevik government. The Sheka practiced torture methods including skinning victims alive, scalping, croning with barbed wire, crucifixion, hanging, stoning to death. Women and children were also victims of the terror. They would sometimes be tortured and raped before being shot. Children between the ages of 8 to 13 were imprisoned and executed. With hot irons, the Bolsheviks tortured those prisoners who were caught. Some victims were actually sliced to pieces, bit by bit, while others were branded with hot irons, their eyes poked out to induce unbearable pain. Burning coals were inserted into women's genitals. Often in views of victims' family members, prisoners were publicly hanged. Communists in Kharkov placed their victims in a row and nailed their hands to a table, cut around their wrist with a knife, poured boiling water over the hands, and pulled off the skin. They poked out eyes, broke bones in legs and arms, and extracted nails, cut off hands, ears, and noses. Victims were submerged in boiling ore or tar. Victims were dosed with petrol and burned alive.
Lazar Kaganovich was the Jewish head of the KGB and was well known for his purges of those who opposed Jewish control. It is argued that Stalin, whose second wife was Kaganovich's sister, was a mere figurehead. Some believe that the numerous Jews below Stalin in all significant positions ran the show. As proof, some point out that many of the churches were burnt to the ground, while the synagogues were left standing. Many priests were forced to sweep the streets and others were murdered. The Jewish Soviet leaders held rabbis in high esteem, and those people who dared to criticize the Jewish supremacy were mercilessly murdered as anti-Semitism became a crime punishable by death in the Soviet Union.
The Jew Kaganovich ordered the deaths of millions and the total destruction of Christian monuments and churches. Among these victims were bishops, professors, doctors, policemen, officers, lawyers, civil servants, journalists, writers, artists, nurses, workers, and farmers. The most intelligent and the highest achieving segment of the population was totally wiped out, which left a population of ignorant workers, peasants, and a powerful Jewish ruling elite. Lenin said, "We must hate. Hatred is the basis of communism. Children must be taught to hate their parents if they're not communists." From the American Hebrew of September 8, 1920, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia was the work of Jewish brains, of Jewish dissatisfaction, of Jewish planning, whose goal is to create a new order in the world. What was performed in so excellent a way in Russia, thanks to Jewish brains, and because of Jewish dissatisfaction and by Jewish planning, shall also through the same Jewish mental and physical forces become a reality all over the world. A righteous Jew, Henry H. Klein, explained that Zionism is a political program for the conquest of the world. Zionism destroyed Russia by violence as a warning to other nations. It is destroying the United States through bankruptcy, as Lenin advised. Zionism wants another world war if necessary to enslave the people. Our manpower is scattered over the world. Will we be destroyed from within, or will we wake up in time to prevent it? The Rabbi Stephen Samuel Wise in New York said, "Some called it communism, but I call it Judaism."
People were being shot day and night throughout the biggest country in the world. Stalin even got to the point of killing people by random, by quarters.
Let's say 100,000 in Tambov district. Okay, that's it. Whoever they grabbed and shot will be fulfilling quota. They wouldn't care about names. Then after the quotas were fulfilled, the local authorities would report to Stalin, to Central Committee, and asked for additional quotas.
Хрущев просил, что лимит вот значит, там, что-то ему там разрешалось, что-то 7 или 8 тысяч врагов народа. Он просил, дайте мне лимит на 17 тысяч.
An additional quota will be given. And after fulfilling, they would again ask for additional quota. And so it will go in circles. It was like a mincemeat machine, you know. It was just killing and killing and killing.
Sometimes the Jewish butchers cut open the stomachs of their victims, pulled out a length of small intestine, nailed it to a telegraph pole, and with the whip forced the victim to run circles around the pole until the whole intestine became unraveled and the victim died the most agonizing death possible. Pregnant Christian women were chained to trees and their babies cut out of their bodies. Some victims in Kiev were placed in a coffin with a decomposing body and buried alive, only to be dug up after half an hour. Lenin was still not satisfied with this and reported, "More power to the terror." The Bolsheviks would eliminate every free thinker. Trotsky wanted every individual to be a rootless soldier of labor, and he thought that all those demanding free speech, free press, and free trade unions should be shot like dogs. If ordered to move, they were forced to obey. If they refused, they were deserters who would be punished with death. Every move was at gunpoint. Trotsky often executed his victims personally in the most cruelest ways. He happily ordered disciplinary executions, and he even ordered children murdered. Officers and their families were executed for disobeying orders. The Jew Grigory Zinoviev, real name Hirsch Apfelbaum, as head of the Communist International, wrote in an article in the Draznaya Gazeta in Moscow, September 1, 1918, "We will make our hearts cruel, hard, and immovable, so that no mercy will enter them, so that they will not quiver at the sight of a sea of enemy blood. We will let loose the floodgates of that sea. Without mercy, without sparing, we will kill our enemies in scores of hundreds. Let them be thousands. Let them drown themselves in their own blood. Let there be floods of blood of the bourgeoisie. More blood, as much as possible." Every people who dared to criticize the regime would be branded as anti-Semitic and punished with death. Christians, priests, and the most attractive youth, and all non-Jewish intellectuals were the first to be exterminated. In years to come, Stalin's crime against humanity would make Lenin's Red Terror crumble in comparison. The Gulag was the Jewish NKVD system of forced labor and extermination camps. Any person suspected of disagreeing with the Jewish Bolshevik government was kidnapped by the Jewish secret police and deported to a gulag.
Туда и обратно. Понял, да? И вот сюда, 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 сюда. Вот здесь вот. По этой дороге. Прямо вот так, вот с обе стороны, вот так вот, вот. Она вся в лагерях, особенно вот сюда, вот здесь, вот. Здесь, кругом лагеря, кругом.
Ты ели по каждый лагерь там, по дороге,
да? Нет, в каждый, господи, мне надо было тогда жить тысячи лет, чтобы каждый лагерь, даже по два дня, и тысячи лет мне надо жить, понимаете, чтобы каждый заглянул. Даже ты представляешь себе, вот на этой дороге, вот на Транссибирской дороге, лагеря были нанизаны, как вот на нитку бусы. Вот, на нитку. Бусы, вот тут
Понял, да? Ну вот это бусы. Понимаешь слово бусы?
Да-да-да.
Вот. Они прямо здесь так и были нанизаны.
Пятерках, да, пятерках, и тогда нас по фамилиям вызывали по пятеркам, так как привезли, как привели, так мы по порядку и были, и тогда нас садили в вагоны. Вагоны такие похожие, но они были хуже, они были деревянные вагоны, такие, тут с собаками, с этими с винтовками, очень много солдат было. Там нам давали по ведро и угля, и потом мерзли дальше уже.
До вечной мерзлоты нужно было вырыть грунт. Значит, фундамент 80 на 80, яма такая. А грунт попадет иногда на 14 метров. И только видно одна звезда. И сколько на эту звезду я смотрела, и знала, что говорила, что и мама на эту звездочку смотрит. Мне надо видеть ее. Обязательно. Это меня удерживало.
А как колодежи из школы?
Как? Очень холодно, очень. Но когда работаешь, то уже не холодно, кровь тебя сохраняет, а потом надежда еще на то, чтобы выжить. Это еще двойная сила. Что это все впереди, что надо честным трудом, как сказано, искупать свою вину перед Родиной. А потом я же строю для себя на своей родине.
У нас женщина сама лежит, опухшая, по-моему. Так, говорит, давай ее сейчас заберем. Что ее, она все равно помрет, завтра за ней еще ехать нужно будет, сегодня. Она просит, что да я же еще живу, я жить хочу, я в доме.
Bet tad tiešām, ka man dēliņu vilka, tad
tos sargi bija noņem. Tā jau viss, kas mira, bērns, nu bērns glabāja pie privātajiem. Tos neskaitīja, ka tie ir apsietināti, tos pie privāti. Mums jau rakpūro. Un tad viens sakal bērnīši nomira. Tad es neatceros, cik lai bija pusgads vai gads bija, tad es atkal vilku to, un tad es tikai aizgāju pie savu dēlu, un tā bija pēdīga reize. Viņa nesas apcīt.
The most infamous of these camps was the desolate island in the Siberian River, Nazino, as known as Cannibal Island. On this island, the inhabitants underwent torture by starvation to the point that they ate each other and survived out of sheer desperation. Almost immediately, the newcomers to the islands were attacked and eaten. Corpses were butchered and human flesh were being cooked and eaten. Several bodies were found with their liver, breasts, calves, heart, and lungs removed.
Вот здесь и людоедство, здесь и все открылось, потому что каждый хотел спастись любыми путями. Не все люди вот были такие, что могли спокойно, поэтому и описывается, что и убивали, и вырезали икры, и вырезали груди, и очень много можно было и других историй вспомнить.
Даже вот допустим, человек только уже вот-вот должен умереть, люди уже стояли и ждали, когда он умрет, чтобы какой-то кусок мяса взять. Сырым мясом ели, сырое мясо ели. Уже не думали, что он больной чем-то или не больной, лишь бы только поесть и хоть может еще день прожить.
Человечье мясо резали и привязывали.
Началась охота за людьми, молодых особенно, за девушками, за молодыми. Их просто или убивали, или просто отрезали, ну, какие-то, что называется, части тела мягкие, на костре жарили, съедали тоже. В общем, страшные вещи начались.
Веников Костя, молодой парень. Он это, к девчонке одной. Такая хорошая девчонка. А он все караулил ее. Приедет и охраняет эту девчонку. А потом вздумал, уехал помыться. Он товарищу наказал, вы за ней приглядывайте. А тот что, столь народу вокруг. А ее привязали. Руки назад к тополине и груди отрезали ей. Икры отрезали, мускулы. Все-все, где можно есть. Голодные люди, есть надо. А парень-то когда приехал, она еще жива была. Хотел спасти, умерла она, истекла. Тут же умерла. И вот, парню-то не повезло.
Изменения. Если на первых стадиях человек, видно, как-то приспосабливается к этому, то постепенно вот этот дефицит веществ начинает сказываться и на психике человека. И здесь на первый план могут всплыть именно из бессознательного наши природные животные инстинкты, такие как каннибализм. Это достаточно нередкое явление в периоды таких больших массовых голоданий, когда голодает большое количество людей.
На другий день моя сестра где-то там ходила по тих лугах, що вона там робила, я не скажу, вже її нема в живих. Вона знаходить черепа дитячого. Вже одварений, вже без волосу, без нічого, такий череп. Вона взяла тако на палочку, йде і крутить. А у нас там по сусідстві жив мужчина. Анон його звали. Каже, що це ти крутиш там? Вона каже, якийсь череп. Ми подивилися, вони подивилися, то він бере маму мою і йдуть до неї. Вони приходять до неї, то в неї вже сокира в крові і на стінах кров. Ну це вже був найстоящий голод. Вони питають її, а де ж ваші діти? Нема. Помирали, то я їх на Трощенському рову похоронила, у канаві Трощенській. Вони пішли шукати, то там нема свіжої землі, нема тієї канави. Приходять знов до неї додому, це мама моя з цим, то я дуже помню. Ой, вони прийшли, то вона вже наварила цього м'яса дитячого, печки колись, печі були не. І в діжечки посоляне м'ясо, це дитяче, вже посоляне, зложене в діжечки. То вони заставили її, вона у мішок, це м'ясо, і вели її у Іванопіль, там була міліція, там був цей НКВД. Та й вона в лісі пропала, серце лопло, і вона не дійшла туди.
The founders of the Gulag death camp system were the two Jews, Naftali Frankel and Levi Birnbaum. The infamous Soviet gulags were under the direct control of the mass-murdering Jew, Genndzich Yagoda. He was not the only one involved in the running of these camps. The Jew Lev Inchir was the commissar for Soviet death camp transit administration. Ferin, Rapoport, Kogan, and Zhuk were commissars of the death camps and slave labor. They also supervised the mass deaths of laborers during the construction of the White Sea-Baltic Canal. Jews were the commandants of 11 out of 12 main gulags, or concentration camps, including the camp system directors Matvei Berman and Herschel Yehuda. A particularly cruel sadist was the Jew Leonid Reichman, head of the NKVD's special department and the organization's chief interrogator. Ironically, communism, aka the workers' paradise, was pretty much the opposite. The policy hurt every worker and benefited only the communists in high power. Everyone who opposed Stalin's collectivization paid with their lives. Communism was not created by the masses to overthrow the bankers. Communism was created by the bankers to overthrow and enslave the masses.
Голод, холод, нужду. В чому же ми виноваті, що так все случилося? І хто за це відповідає? За всі наші муки і страдання. Встретишь папу, маму, скажи папе, что я еще 8-й год добиваюсь, чтобы его была честь оправдана. Я его наказ выполняю. Он говорил мне, доченька, ты у меня самая будешь умная. Так постарайся, придет время, добейся правды нашей. Что ни за что вы страдаете, ни за что я пострадал.
The idea was to destroy old order in Europe.